Let me quote an article that I just saw this past week. It's actually coming in from the intelligent design movement. It happens to focus on an article that appeared in the Nature magazine, the scientific magazine, about the cell shredder recycler called a protozoome. I'd never even heard of this thing at all before. The ribosome I'd heard of. The ribosome actually makes new proteins. The protozoome chops them up and puts them and breaks them back down into their constituent parts again. It says, this large barrel-shaped molecular machine has a flip-top lid like those trash cans with a foot pedal. Only this one is much more elaborate. It validates the trash, pulls it in with a motor, shreds it inside, and new high-resolution images of the lid portion by Lander, also in Nature, reveal the workings of this intricate architecture as never before. So it's actually in every single cell in your body right now, all, what is it, 10,000 billion of them, so 10 to the power of 13 cells that we've got. Every single one of them has a number of these, what are they called, protozoomes within them. And as they're constantly making more and more protein through the ribosomes, but these particular things, if one gets badly folded or badly constructed or one is past its sell-by date or whatever, these things go around and gobble them up. Now you wonder, well, how did they actually manage to do this? And it says it's composed of numerous proteins, protein subunits arranged into functional complexes and is capable of degrading a wide variety of protein types. The barrel portion of the machine where protein degradation occurs had already been described previously. It says, inside the barrel, which is a stack of four rings with a cavity in the middle composed of 28 protein parts, active sites on the inside walls cleave polypeptide chains into short segments about 7 to 9 amino acid units long, which can then be reused by the cell directly or further degraded into individual amino acids for recycling. So it's got an automatic recycling unit inside every cell where if a protein doesn't get generated in the right way, and I'm talking about your cells of our eyes, as we're looking out through these eyes of ours, we're looking at the screen, if those of you online, or and myself, for those of you that are here, those cells have these automatic regeneration, recycling units within them. It says, obviously, this dangerous interior must be protected, lest it runs amok like a chainsaw murderer. That's why an elaborate lid structure composed of 19 more protein parts guards the entry gate and checks the credentials of every protein that enters. You can imagine that if this thing just ran amok, it would just gobble up the cell. It would just tear the cell apart. How did the first one ever get made? How do you make one of these things without releasing this thing within the cell? It's all going to be gradually, carefully actually constructed. To be validated, a target protein must have previously been tagged for destruction by other molecular machines. The tag is a ubiquitous protein called, appropriately, ubiquitin, found in all eukaryote cells. Now, that eukaryote cell is one that has a nucleus in it. Now that basically every cell in your body, every cell in a cow's body, every cell in virtually anybody, body's body, is a eukaryote cell. The other ones, like bacteria, don't have cell membranes. Therefore, they are slightly different. They are prokaryotes, I think they're called. It says ubiquitin found in all eukaryote cells. Ubiquitin is coded or encoded by redundant genes to ensure that an ample supply is available in all times. Before being used as a tag, ubiquitin must be activated by additional enzymes through a sequence of checks and balances. Then the tag is fastened onto a tail of the target protein. So something goes around and it actually finds a protein that's not been folded properly. It'll tag it. It'll put a tag on the tail of it. An unfolded portion long enough to fit into the protozoome chamber. Other enzymes then attach additional ubiquitin tags, and the protozoome requires 4 ubiquitin tags to allow entry. So it has to actually check, and it comes along and it says, right, has this got 4 ubiquitin tags on it? If it does, then it gets threaded into the machine and shredded. If it doesn't, it gets left alone. Once tagged, the doom protein is conveyed to the protozoome by a process that remains to be understood. The entry into the protozoome is governed by 2 main complexes, the lid and the base, that lock together. The lid is called a regulatory particle, is much more than a mere MUP particle. It's a complex of specific proteins tasked with recognizing the ubiquitin tags, removing them, initiating the unfolding of the target protein, and starting its descent into the barrel. Just underneath the lid, the base is a complex of six proteins forming a ring over the barrel opening. It grabs validated proteins and threads them into the chamber. And this is going on thousands and thousands of times every minute in your and my body. That much was known. For years, biochemists have been eager to understand how the validation, detagging, unfolding and initiation process works. And here are the exciting new finds that Lander et al. Have revealed in the sub-nanometer resolution about the regulatory particle lid and its base. So for the first time, they've actually been able to look at this thing. Now, it was actually discovered that there was such an object back in the late 70s. They didn't really know what it did and how it worked until the mid-80s. So this is all since Mr. Armstrong's death that they've started to understand this. And only literally in the last few months have they actually been able to photograph with electron microscope the lid of this machine, which is inside every single one of your cells. 1. When isolated from the protosome, the lid changes its structure to prevent exposure of its detagging machinery. You know, if this lid suddenly detagged everything in existence, it could cause mayhem in the cell. So what it does, it folds itself into a certain shape to make sure that the machinery that detags doesn't get in contact with anything. The lid then fits to the base at an angle and makes extensive contact with both the base and the barrel core. 3. When the lid docks at the base, parts move to grip the base and expose the active sites. You imagine how small these things are. You know, 10,000 billion cells are in your body, and in each of them, there are several of these. The two proteins on the opposite sides of the lid serve as docking points for the ubiquitin tags. Although only one is necessary to initiate the degradation process, the two can work independently or together. The distance between the tag docking protein and the tag cleaving protein ensures that the four ubiquitin tags are present. So precise distance and allows to make sure that that's how they check that the four are present on the tail. The tail of the target protein is then inserted into the core. Once the tags have been validated, another protein cleaves the tag from the tail. Another protein off to the side separates the four tags into individual ubiquitin molecules, and then the six proteins at the base are arranged like a spiral staircase. This means that either the protein uses a rotary mechanism to thread the polypeptide into the barrel, or remains statically in place as their individual moving parts grab and walk the polypeptide down the stairs. So it spirals it into the digester. And then the digester, as soon as any protein comes into the digester part of it, it chops it into pieces according to what is needed and spews them out the back. And that's going on thousands of times a minute. I don't know. I think it's actually thousands of times a second within our bodies right now. Turn over to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. Because it's when you really get to examine in the detail that we've got today the body that we've been given that we really do make sense of what David wrote here in Psalm 139 verse 14. It says, I will praise you, for I am fearfully, wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows right well. You know, just the limited degree of understanding that he had allowed him to write this under inspiration anyway. My substance was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lower parts of the earth, or that which underlies the solid. And what we're looking at now and what we're able to examine today with electron microscopes as we have is what is indeed underlying the solid that we see. This solid that we see, I mean, these things are so small. They're molecules, the protein molecules are made of, and it's the shape of the molecular structure that governs the use of the various chemicals within the cell. Your eyes saw my substance, yet being unperfect, and in your book all of my members were written, which in continuous were fashioned, when as they, yet there were none of them. So it all got, you know, came together according to the structure of the DNA, according to the structure of the cells, and the dividing cells that were there, to make a child. And at the same time, anything that wasn't formed correctly would have been gobbled up by one of these machines that are in the cell. But notice verse 17, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God, and how great is the sum of them. And indeed, those thoughts are what we really do need to look at. And what I'd like to do today is I want to continue the sermon on series of sermons on health and deal with the subject of food, because these cells, your body, my body, everything that we are physically has come from the food either we've eaten or our mothers have eaten when we're in the womb, or mind you, it's every 8 years the cells basically regenerate themselves anyway, so all you are really is come from the food you've eaten. So it is a vital part of that. But it is the fact that it's not just the food that we eat, it's not just the fact that we are wonderfully and incredibly made, and how incredible that process is, but also how precious those thoughts are. And it's the thoughts of God in relationship to food, which is what I want to really concentrate on today. Because today's society is being constructed in such a way that it's not possible to have perfect food. It just isn't. I don't care what kind of food we get, it has been corrupted. Everything has been polluted or corrupted in some way. And it's becoming worse and worse as we go on. So what we really do need to do, however, is we need to learn the principles. We need to learn the principles of obtaining the correct kind of food. And we need to also be applying those principles as best we can. Because it's a part of the way of God. It's part of, as he says, David says here, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. It's the thinking of God. How did God construct it originally? How did God make the food system that we've got? And how do we therefore fit as best we can within that system? We can't do it perfectly, but it doesn't mean to say we don't therefore throw up our hands and do nothing. And this is what I want to try and convey today, is the fact that the responsibilities that we have to do it as best we can within whatever environment we find ourselves in. And the reason for doing it that way is so that we can then teach that way and the principles in the world tomorrow. You know, God's way and God's principles have got to have to be taught in the world tomorrow. And if we aren't actually learning them now, what are we going to teach? We aren't. And when I say learning them, I don't mean learning them by book knowledge. I mean learning them by applying them, by actually living that way ourselves. And say, look, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever they turn right, whenever they turn left. And it certainly is the case that when we're looking at food today, in today's society, there's one of the great, you know, as far as today's society is concerned, compared to yesteryear, the big, big problem, and this is the big problem, is that human beings are not looked upon as potential sons of God, or looked upon as sons of God. They're looked upon as consumers. That's the problem. And once you, in order to get the principle right, we've got to put that right first. To look upon human beings, as potential sons of God, as potential receptacles of the very Spirit of God, not as mere consumers of food. That is the problem. And if we're going to, you know, take anything from the sermon today, take that point, that consumers is not where it's at. It is the fact that we are to be sons of God, sons of the living God. The temple of God is the very body that we've been given. And the areas I want to cover today, first of all, I want to talk about balance in this subject, because we can get wacky on it. We can quite easily become wacky over the subject, and it's vital that we do have the right kind of balance involved. Secondly, I want to talk about vegetables and fruit, in other words, the plant, things that we eat which are plant derived. Thirdly, I want to talk about meat, the things that we eat which are animal derived. And fourthly, I want to talk about making things as natural as they possibly can. because that really is the essence of it, making things as natural as possible, making things the way, or as near as to the way as God made them as possible. That is what we're looking at. So those are the only 4 points that I've got today. But as I say, if you take nothing from this sermon, take it from it the fact that the principle, overriding principle, is that we're not consumers, which is the way that the world is trying to force us. It's trying to make us into consumers. It's trying to get as much money and economically make as much money from us as possible. And even we ourselves, we rush around like headless chickens, grabbing something on the run and shoving it in, consuming it and shoving it in our mouth, instead of giving any thanks, or any thought. And giving of thanks is a vital part of that. In the subject of balance, however, turn over to Romans 14 and let's remind ourselves of this scripture once again in Romans chapter 14. Because in today's society, in the subject of food, we can become wacky. We can become unbalanced in the area. But here in Romans chapter 14, it says very clearly in verse 17, it says, "For the kingdom of God," and let's face it, that's what the focal point of our life is. It's to be part of the family of God, which is the kingdom of God. And part of that family are sons and daughters of God. Let's say we're not consumers, we're sons and daughters of God. So this also fits within this subject. "For the kingdom of God is not meat and drink." It's not a physical kingdom. It's a spirit-born kingdom. That's what is important. So our focus has got to be in the right place. It's not meat and drink, but it's righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. Now that second part should tell us many things as well. And that is that, first of all, it's joy in the Holy Spirit. And the temple of our, that Holy Spirit is our physical body. It is our physical body. So if that physical body is so sick that it can't act as a correct temple of God's Spirit, then there's a problem for it. It's also righteousness. It's also thinking along God's way, thinking in God's way. It's not the meat and drink. It's the thinking in God's way that's important. It's making sure that we look upon human beings not as consumers, but as sons of God. It's having the spiritual dimension to the subject that is important. And there's a great deal within that verse that we need to take to mind and to keep in our mind. And certainly is that the fact is that it's not food and drink, but the principles we are going to have to teach. We're going to have a world made to such a degree, walking in God's way, that when the individuals rise in the great white throne judgment, they'll look at that world and they'll think that they're in paradise. Now that world is going to have to be transformed by you and me. And to do that, the thinking has got to be transformed by you and me. And if we're going to do that, our thinking has got to be transformed by the Spirit of God. And our thinking and the way we look at things has got to be according to God's way and according to God's thinking. Now, again, in this subject of food, turn back to Proverbs 15. And these are a couple of proverbs we'll look at in this area, because I dealt with this area to a great degree last time. But in Proverbs chapter 15, always remember, in this area that we're not consumers. We've just read verse 1, the soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. But I want to look at verse 17, or verse 16. "Better is a little with a fear of the eternal than great treasure and trouble therewith." It's better to have a little with a fear of God, with the right mindset, with the right principles in place. "And better is a dinner of herbs, a dinner of vegetables, where love is," the very descriptive character of God, where that kind of concern is around the table, "than a stalled ox and hatred therewith." There's all the steaks you could possibly eat, and all every single piece of food in completely the right place. But if around the table you've got contention and strife, then there's a problem. And it's interesting that it is in that same chapter that says a soft answer turns away wrath. And the use of a soft answer around the table is necessary to make sure that the food that we eat has the right kind of effect and the right kind of gives us the nutrition that we need. Turn over the page, or in fact, not even over the page, in the same opposite page in my Bible anyway, in chapter 17, verse 1, is the same basic thought. Better is a dry morsel, in other words, just a dry piece of bread. It's better just to have that, and quietness therewith, than a house full of sacrifices, in other words, you know, stalled ox was sacrificed, house filled with sacrifice, a house filled I think it's got a side note. It actually says good cheer. In other words, you're really living it up, but you've also got strife. In other words, it is better to have that quietness around the table. So, when we're looking at the subject of balance, the principles are what we need to be teaching. It's not the food and drink. It's looking at individuals that are eating it as potential sons of God. That is what's important. And the food and drink, therefore, fit within those principles. In order to do that, it's not what food you put on the table. It's the atmosphere around the table as well. The two have go hand in glove. The attitude of mind that we have when we sit down for a meal, when we sit down together for a meal, and we discuss whatever we discuss, and we do it in quietness and in an attitude and a way of love. Now, there are all kinds of ideas that we can get, and I just want to deal with one, because there's all kind of wacky, I mean, every magazine you pick up, virtually, will have some kind of wacky diet in it. A diet for doing something, normally losing weight of some description. But the fact is that the principles are what is vitally important. Let's take one of them. Now, I'm not saying that we don't go ahead and diet, because we do need to diet sometimes. Sometimes we do eat too much food, and we certainly eat too much of the wrong kind of food. We put on too much weight, and therefore we need to diet. Sometimes we have gluten intolerances. Sometimes we have milk intolerances, various different intolerances, and the food has been just so corrupted these days that we've got to be very careful with certain foods in certain cases. But I want to deal with one which some people do find beneficial, but I want you to make sure that we do not look upon it as something which is biblical, and that is separating proteins and carbohydrates. Now, separating proteins and carbohydrates can help for a period of time in certain cases, but don't look upon that as biblical. Let's have a look at Genesis 18. Now, I haven't done it myself, but I've heard of I know a nutritionist who said that she'd done it and gone through the scriptures, who literally gone through the entire Bible looking for incidences of food. And where she found proteins, she would always find carbohydrate. And here is an example of one that you can turn to, Genesis 18, notice verse 6, and it says, Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it and make cakes upon the hearth. So there's your carbohydrate. And Abraham ran to the herd and fetched a calf tender and good, gave it to a young man, and he hastened to dress it. There's your protein. And he took butter and milk and the calf and the calf which he had dressed and set them before them, and he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. So they had bread, they had the calf, presumably it would be boiled and maybe barbecued in some way. It's clear that they had butter and milk as well as the calf. Let's have a look at another one, Genesis 27. And it says, this here is Jacob coming into Isaac being blind and trying to masquerade that it's actually his brother that's coming in. And Rebekah took a goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, verse 15, and put him on Jacob and put the skins on his kids, on his goats, on his hand and his smooth on his neck. And then she gave the savory meat and the bread which he had prepared to the hand of his son Jacob. Now, I remember he'd just supposedly gone out to do a hunt of the venison, and she'd taken a goat and gone ahead and prepared it in the same way to masquerade as if it was venison. And it was deceitful, yes, it was lies, yes. But I want you to notice, you know, forget the deceit, forget the lies. Notice what, in fact, what it was. It was that there was also there was savoury meat and the bread. It was the venison that was prepared in a certain way, and it was also bread as well. There's the, you have the carbohydrates and you have the protein together. You can go through and you can see many of the scriptures. We won't turn to them all, obviously. But you can even see the time when Christ came along in the end of John. And he said, was it John or wherever, he says, look, have you got any food? And he said, they gave him some food, and they gave him some fish and a honeycomb. Fish being protein, honeycomb being carbohydrate. And you'll find this over and over again throughout Scripture. So, wacky diets, be careful. Don't get to the idea that some wacky diet, because we've seen it in the church, believe you me, we've seen these kind of things in the church. This wacky diet is it. This wacky diet is the answer to everything. That's not the case. Make sure it's biblical, and the biblical diet does actually indicate that carbohydrates and proteins are eaten together. The fact is that food is there to be enjoyed. You know, again, in the subject of balance, it is enjoying food that is... We've been made flesh and blood. We've been made with a stomach that enjoys itself when the food actually arrives. You notice yourself, you're buttering yourself a piece of bread, or you just about put some honey on it, or something like this. Just notice what's happening in the mouth at the time. you're drooling, quite frankly. Turn over to Colossians chapter 2. But it is. It's designed to be enjoyable. It's designed something that way by the Father and Christ, and implemented by Christ when he created mankind. Adam and the initial example of mankind. But Colossians chapter 2, notice in verse 18, it says, let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshipping of angels, intruding into the things that had not been seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. Now here you've got this Gnosticism that is being discussed here, this means of superior spiritual knowledge, spiritual knowing. They do it in two ways. You can either do it through Epicurean and hedonistic ways, or you can do it through the Stoic and ascetic way. And this is... talking, it goes into the Stoic and ascetic way. It says, not holding the head, from which all the body and joints and bands, having nourishment, ministered and knit together, increases with the increase of God. Therefore, if you are dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are you subject to ordinances or dogmas? Touch not, taste not, handle not, which are to perish with the using, after the commandments and the doctrines of men. You know, food has been given to us to be enjoyed. We are not to go down the Gnostic route and the Gnostic heresy that, you know, we're so much more spiritual by eating bread and gruel, you know, water and gruel every day. I mean, that is not necessary. It is an enjoyable experience. Which things have indeed have a show of wisdom in the will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, but not in any honour of the satisfying of the flesh. And God made us a certain way. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 30, the final scripture in this area of balance, that we need to make sure we understand that. Because it does say, though the Lord give you, in verse 20, the bread of adversity and the waters of affliction. Now, yes, it's talking about the problems with having bread and having water. As far as Israel is concerned, that is the focus of the verse. But it's interesting that we today have problems with bread. We have polluted water. We have bread of affliction, of adversity. We have waters of affliction. But eventually, And so does the world. So does the world that we are a part of. And they are living also in a world that's been corrupted and been polluted. But yet your teachers shall not be removed into a corner any more, but your eyes shall see your teachers. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn right hand to the right hand, and when you turn to the left. Those teachers need to be us. And in the area of food, we need to have the principles in mind to be able to teach. We need to be able to understand them, and not only in mind, but actually being implemented ourselves at this present time. We ourselves need to be implementing those principles. And that doesn't matter whether we are living on a farm or whether we are living with a house with a garden, which we have, or whether you're living in a condo or a flat somewhere with no garden and all the food comes in from the supermarket. Even so, we still need to live this the way of life, and according to the way of life, is according to God's way of life, trying to apply the principles to the best of our ability in the circumstance that we find ourselves in today, because of this verse here in Isaiah 30, that those eyes are not going to be removed into, the teachers are not going to be removed into a corner, but we are going to have to actually be teaching. We're going to have to be teaching in order for the millennium to be looked upon by the Great White Throne Judgment as a utopia. And it's going to be converting. I'm sure there's a great deal that we don't understand that we have yet to learn. But I can guarantee this, that if our mind is such that we just simply throw up our hands and just say, oh, it doesn't make any difference, it might eat whatever I like, it doesn't make any odds. Well, that's not the attitude of mind. That's not the way at all. Turn over to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. Because when we come to food itself, we're looking at a basis for our health and a basis for our food supply. And that basis is based on, as I say, not the fact that we are consumers, not the fact that we just have to grab something to eat on the run, but that we are potential sons of God, that we are actually now sons of God, as a receptacle of the very Spirit of God, a temple of the very Holy Spirit of God. And here in Genesis 1, verse 26, it says, and God said, let us make man in our image, and after our likeness, in the shadow, physically like, looking like God himself. Likeness being the character, implying the character of God, having the same kind of mindset, mind frame of mind, creator. In many ways. And let them have dominion over the fish and the sea and the fowl of the air and the cattle and all the earth and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So here we see ourselves having been made like God, as an image of God, as a likeness of God. And in chapter 3, notice in verse 19, it says, in the sweat of your faith shall you eat bread, until you return to the ground, for out of it were you taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. We are dirt. We are, that's really, I mean, it's not just dust. If you go out in Wales, you don't find much dust. You find an awful lot of dirt and an awful lot of mud. And the mud you are, clay we are, and to clay we shall return. And that's the way it is. That is exactly what we are. It's interesting that we were watching a film the other night on photosynthesis. Now, photosynthesis is the way which plants take carbon dioxide from the air and they convert it along with water into carbohydrates. Carbohydrates, in other words, hydrogenating the carbon dioxide. And in the byproduct that comes out of that process is oxygen, and therefore the animals breathe the oxygen. But it's interesting that he reduced everything down. He said all that is involved is water and carbon dioxide, and that's a load of bunkum. The fact is that dirt we are, and to dirt we shall return, and there's an awful lot of mineralization in there as well. And it's because the scientific world has looked upon the very basic areas, the basic cell structure, the NPK, nitrogen, phosphate and potash, as the basis. And then you add water and you add carbon dioxide and you have a plant. Well, no, you don't. You have a demineralized plant, and that is a real major problem. But it's dust you are, dirt you are, and to dirt you shall return. And it's certainly something we need to learn when we're looking at the subject of food. As it says in chapter 2, in verse 7, "And the eternal God formed man of the dirt of the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul, a living nephesh." That living physical creature, that breathing creature, is made of dirt. It's made of dirt. That's what we are. And we therefore have got to go ahead and replenish that dirt, if you like, by the food that we eat. The mineralization, it comes out of the ground. And if the ground is sick, then the plants will be sick, then the animals will be sick, and then we will be sick. And that is a major problem today, because they push the ground. They push, yes, you get the cell structure, yes, you get a great green leaf, but what's the mineralization? That's the problem. You load on the nitrogen, you can make a green leaf wonderfully. You know, you have these huge cabbages, wonderfully. But the mineralization isn't there. They'll be eaten by pests. So what do? You put a pesticide on there to kill the pest. That's, you know, it's the cart before the horse. It's going the wrong way about it completely. The point is, in verse 8, it says, "And the eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man who he had formed." Our place is in a garden. That is the basis. That's the bedrock of our food. Our food comes from a garden. It should come from a garden environment. That's the way we were made. That's what God, the way God made. "And out of the ground made the eternal God," and remember who we're talking about, Jesus Christ now being the eternal God, "to grow every tree that's pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Now, these symbolic trees are what is concentrated on within this account. But the fact is that the plants, and the animals as well, but the plants, the plant life was there and was given, and certainly all the plants, the trees, were given as the means of having something to eat. Interesting. One of those trees undoubtedly was the olive. Here is an article from Wednesday, January the 25th of this year. It says, "Fried food linked to heart disease is a myth." Notice, fried food linked to heart disease is a myth. If you use olive oil. So you've just done research and hey, all of a sudden fried food is not the problem. It's the oil you cook it in. Well, you know, when they came up with the idea that fried food was the problem back in the 70s and 60s or whatever it was when they came up to this idea, the church basically pointed this out, but it was, you know, dismissed. But it says, "Regularly eating fried food does not cause heart attacks, provided that olive oil or sunflower oil is used in the cooking, according to researchers. A study published in the British Medical Journal said that there's mounting research that it is the type of oil and whether or not it has been used before that really matters. It found no association between the frequency of eating fried food in Spain, where olive oil and sunflower oil are prevalent, and the incidence of serious heart disease." So again, when we're looking at this subject, we see where it says here, he made the trees, and not only pleasant to the eye, not only good for food, but pleasant to the eye as well. But one of those trees would undoubtedly be the olive tree as well. And if you notice in verse 29, the preceding verse, so chapter 1, verse 29. "And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of the tree, yielding seed to you, it shall be for food." So, you know, you leave something to go to seed, and it will. We had parsnips this last year. They'd been grown the previous year, they left to go to seed over the past year, and they actually were over 6 feet, about 8 feet tall, something like that, the parsnip seed. And I've got a bag of parsnip seed now. I mean, you imagine how much money you're actually making out of parsnip seed. There's a phenomenal amount of money, like the charge of these little tiny packets. Well, I let about two parsnips go to seed, something like that. and I've got a bag which is, oh, I don't know, what is it? If you made a round ball of it, it would probably be something like eight inches across, a spherical ball of parsnip seed, out of two parsnips. But it says, the every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree which is the fruit of the tree, will be for you for food. So the basis, the foundation, and it's interesting also, it says in verse 31, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And evening and morning were the sixth day. So having made this, it was a good system. He could see the beauty that was there, the way in which it had been created. And the basis of it, vegetables are the basis. Vegetables and fruits and nuts and so on, coming from trees, coming from vegetation. That is at the basis in a garden environment. That is the basis of food. It's not animals, although animals are important, and you go and look at the animals, and particularly when you're looking at ruminants, they're vital for the land to go ahead and replenish the bacteria that are in there. But the basis of our food supply is the vegetable and the fruit and the nuts coming from vegetable matter. Turn over to Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. We need to understand that something is going to happen. And it says, repent, in verse 19, and therefore, and be converted. Be changed, be converted from one way of thinking to another way of thinking, amongst other things. That your sins may be blotted out. So that, probably better translated, the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord. And we're looking for the glorious liberty of the sons of God, as he mentions in Romans 8. That glorious liberty is going to be because we understand the principles and we're applying the principles. And at the foundation level, it is the fact that human beings are potential sons of God. They are not consumers. And in that area, it says, and he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, for this liberty, for this time of refreshing, who the heavens must receive until the time of the restitution of all things. Now, we've just had a look at the basis. Where did God place man? He placed him in a garden. What did he give him to eat? He gave him the vegetables and fruits and nuts. That forms the basis. And the restitution of all things which God has spoken of for the mouth of the holy prophets since the world began. We're living in a world today that is under the influence of Satan. 2 Corinthians 4:4, he's the God of this world. And Ephesians 2:2, he broadcasts his mindset, and mankind picks it up and acts in a satanic way. And the constructions that we've got for our food chain within the human sphere, is satanly or satanically inspired idea, concept. And as we go towards the end, so that will become more and more so. And that's what we've got today. That is the problem we've got today. The human beings are being treated as consumers, almost like as part of the industrialization process. They come at the end consumer that gobbles up whatever, and then we'll go ahead and sell them some more. And it's all to do with profit, it's all to do with grabbing and taking. But this is talking about the restitution of all things. And in that restitution, if we look over in Micah chapter 4, in Micah chapter 4, it says, but in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Eternal shall be established in the top of the mountains. In other words, the government of God, in verse 1. And it shall be exalted above the hills, all the lesser governments, and the people shall flow to it. So it will attract, people will see what they is going on. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Eternal, and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. It will be coming from the children of God. This is the glorious liberty of the children of God, who understand the principles. And what is one of the things that they will be implementing? The restitution of all things. What will they be teaching? And he'll judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off. There shall be their swords to plowshares and their spears to pruning hooks. So there'll be agricultural implements Well, not implements of war, not going and taking something from somebody else. Not, and if the attitude of mind of taking something from somebody else has been taken away and is replaced, it's not just a case of not taking from somebody else, it's giving to somebody else. If the idea of taking from somebody else has been taken away, you can guarantee the idea of taking from the land has been taken away as well. And instead of taking from the land, you give to the land. Nor shall they lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine, under his fig tree. Not a Marxist vine and a Marxist fig tree, but his vine and his fig tree. And none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken it. And the people God is preparing at this present time will be implementing it. And they'll be implementing it as part of the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's what it's all about. And God's way to health, God's way of life, looking at Genesis 1 and 2, and even 3, it's clearly based on a garden. It's garden-based. Looking at here, and you see the restitution of all things in Acts chapter 3, and you look at here, you find them under his own vine, he's under his own fig tree. You're looking at the same thing. You're looking at the garden, a garden environment. And that garden environment and the basis of health rising from vegetables and fruit and nuts, that is the basis. That is the thing that is necessary. And the problem is today is that that has been corrupted, that has been damaged. This is coming from a Country Living magazine called Unearthing the Secrets of the Soil. And it talks about beneath our feet lies a mini-universe packed with minerals and trace elements essential to our health. Learn how to use them in your diet and guard against deficiencies. And it goes on, it says, when organic matter is added to the soil, busy bacteria and other microorganisms such as fungi flourish and plants will be healthy and nutritionally rich. But the agrochemicals of modern farming suppress the rich microbial life in the soil. Phosphates, which are used extensively, bind to minerals, making them less available to plants. And though the resulting crops may look big and healthy, and the yields are impressive, they are nutritionally inferior. Now that is a major problem today. A major, major problem. What does the supermarket do? Well, it goes for look. What does it look like? How does it look on the shelf? What's the shelf life? Does it go from to the nutrition? If it does, it gives a false impression. As we'll go on and see, it says, over decades of intensive farming, the mineral content of fruit and vegetable crops has declined steadily. When the nutritionist David Thomas, who runs a supplement company, Trace Concern, studied the detailed composition of foods analysis of nutrient contents published by the UK Agricultural Ministry since 1930, he was staggered by what he found. Now, if I can just interject a personal note here. Judy and I know an individual who is a nutritionist. She's a qualified nutritionist. And in her training, when she was being trained as a nutritionist, she was friendly with another lady who was an elderly lady who was also a nutritionist and actually had been in this field for many, many years. She was the chemist who actually did the original analysis and the composition of food, and it was done back in the 1930s. So it's a direct link from what this lady we know, going right the way back to the 1930s, and she verified and she stressed to Hazel that basically this had been the case. What I'm giving you here is absolutely dead right. I'm talking about it almost first-hand, not first-hand, but second-hand anyway. Between 1930 and 1980, and I'd say probably today it's even more, levels of calcium declined by 75% in broccoli, 74% in spring onions, 55% in strawberries. The magnesium content of carrots fell by 75%. The level of iron was down in Swedes by 71%. And by 60% in spinach. And on the list goes. It's not just, these are not abnormal figures at all. As I say, talking to this lady and about what she knows for a fact, these things have gone downwards by then. And why has it gone backwards? What has actually happened? Well, basically, it was organic at that time. Sir Albert Howard at Lahore in India was knighted by Victoria for his work on composting. He was knighted for it. But what then happened? Well, along came the First World War. What then happened? Well, they had to make armaments, nitroglycerin being a vital component of the armaments. Nitroglycerin, the manufacture was stepped up to an enormous degree. The chemical manufacturers were in high demand. And then come the end of the war, what do? Well, they had to use the facilities that they've got. Therefore, they make not nitroglycerin anymore. They make nitrogen fertilizers. And those nitrogen fertilizers have been used. And what does nitrogen fertilizer do? It forces the plant. It forces the plant, it gives it body, it makes the leaves incredibly green, but it destroys the mineralization. And it says, the level of iron was down in Swedes by 71% and 60% in spinach. Losses of other minerals and trace elements are likely to be on the same scale. And thanks to the refining of grains and industrial processing of many basic foods, these low levels of nutrients are being eroded still further or are missing completely from some foods. Refined white flour stripped of its German bran has lost nearly 80% of its zinc and magnesium, over 50% of its potassium, 80% of its chromium. Trace elements such as selenium and chromium are needed in tiny quantities, but they are still crucial for our health. I mean, you imagine that molecule I gave as the introduction, that tiny, tiny machine within every single one of our cells. The construction of such a machine doesn't just take NPK and a bit of water, you know, HTO and CO2. Yes, that's predominant. That's the predominant. It's a carbohydrate. It's with nitrogen built up, bolted on, which makes a protein. But there are trace elements. Why? Because those proteins have got to fold into very precise shapes. And to fold into the precise shapes, they've got to have the trace elements there as well. If you don't have the trace elements, then you've got problems. And if you don't have that little machine in there, what do you have? You have Alzheimer's. You have Parkinson's. You have all these other degenerative diseases. And they've linked the damage in those protein destruction machines. They've linked that to things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and these many of these diseases. So the trace elements are needed in tiny quantities, but they are still crucial to our health. A huge volume of reputable study has demonstrated that deficiencies in one or more of these vitally inorganic elements can make us vulnerable to a Pandora's box of human miseries, including cancers and diabetes. So we've got to make sure we understand that when we're looking at the subject of food, when we're looking at the subject of where is the basis, well, it's very much, you know, the answer does indeed lie in the soil. It really does. And if the soil is not put right, you know, as the basis, then you're going to have a problem you're going to have the problems that we've got today in the Western world. You get cases of people that have come from overseas, say in an African country where it's totally organic and they have no degenerative diseases. They come across here into the West and they live in the West without, in the first year, they have no degenerative diseases. 10 years and they're back, they've got the same degenerative diseases as the Western population has. Because ours is mass-produced, it's forced. And it is, we're living in this polluted area. Turn over to Genesis again, turn back to Genesis, and we will look at the subject of meat. Because they say it is an important aspect. But in Genesis chapter 7, he says in verse 2, he says, of every clean beast you shall take to you by sevens, of male and his female, and two beasts that are not clean by twos, the male and his female. So clean beasts and unclean beasts were recognized at the time of Noah. In chapter 8, notice verse 20. It says, "And Noah builded an altar to the Eternal and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered a burnt offering on the altar." And in the context of that, in the context of the clean beasts, and again, they partook of the sacrifices in most cases. If it's a burnt offering, no, that would be completely burnt. But in many of the other offerings, it would be partaken of by the person offering. In chapter 9, verse 3, it says, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things." Now, it's all things which is then in the context of the clean animals. It's not just that we eat anything we want, but in that context. "But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat." So even in that context, the blood is not to be eaten. Now, as I say, the kind of animals that are eaten, turn over to Leviticus chapter 11. Leviticus chapter 11. We find here the chapter regarding the clean and unclean beasts, clean and unclean food, animals. And here in verse 44, it says, "For I am the Eternal your God. You shall therefore sanctify yourself, clean yourself up, and you shall be holy, clean. For I am holy, neither shall you defile yourself with any manner of creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. For I am the Eternal that brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God, and you shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." That's the reason for clean and unclean animals. Now, it's a physical thing as far as we know. I say as far as we know because it could, yes, it's a physical thing, but it could actually be influencing the mind. It doesn't say whether, in fact, it's purely a physical reason for having clean and unclean animals. It could be that we start thinking like a pig if we eat something laden with the hormones that is in that kind of animal. "This is the law of the beast and the fowl and every living creature that moves in the waters and every creature that creeps upon the earth, to make a difference between the unclean and the clean, between the beast that may be eaten and the beast that should not be eaten." Now, applying that principle, we can see other areas as well. If we turn back to Leviticus chapter 3, there's a bit more than just clean and unclean animals. It goes a good deal more. In fact, we can extend it. We can extend it even to the type of animal, because again, they've done research to see regarding cholesterol, butter, for instance, that is coming from the cows or the goats, and they've done research into butter coming from various cows that are fed in certain ways. Cows that are fed organically on grass, the cholesterol isn't there. It doesn't, you know, it just isn't there in the butter to the same degree. And in fact, it's got beneficial oils start appearing in their place, and the detrimental oils within the butter is lessened significantly. So, as far as the grass is concerned, feeding the animals, therefore they get a benefit. But when you start mixing in a grain and force feeding them and pushing them, then you start getting problems. Then you start getting the cholesterol. And it's the same as the research that they've done with the frying of food. They assume the frying of food in any oil was the same as any other oil. But that's not the case. And there's a great deal more sophistication there. Here in chapter 3 of Leviticus, in verse 12, it says, "And if his offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before the Eternal. And he shall lay his hands on his head of it and kill it before the tabernacle of the congregation. And the sons of Aaron shall sprinkle the blood thereof upon the altar around about. And he shall offer thereof his offering, even an offering made by fire to the Eternal, the fat that covers the inwards, and all the fat that is on the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them." And the fat that's upon them is a suet. So we shouldn't be eating suet. Suet is often, as we go on, and we'll see that any kind of fat in that regard is not to be eaten. But the two kidneys are also discarded. So it is very, very... It's not an absolute within the church that you should never eat kidney. But the indication is there. It was not to be eaten with a sacrifice. It was always discarded along with the suet that surrounds the kidney. Now, the suet is almost like a jelly. When in a live animal, it's like a jelly. In fact, it's there to cushion and protect the kidneys from damage from outside. But when it dries, then it forms a suet which is crumbly, which is the crumbly fat, which is surrounding the kidneys. So the two kidneys and the fat that is on them, which is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver with the kidneys, that he will take it away. And the priest shall burn them on the altar. It's the food of the offering made by fire, a sweet savour. All the fat is the eternal's. It shall be a perpetual statute for you in all your generations, throughout all your dwellings, that you eat neither fat nor blood. So fat and blood are not to be eaten. Now, there's a bit more to it than that. If you go on, now remember the context of what we're looking at. What are the context? The context is the offering of a goat. Well, if you go on into chapter 7 over a couple of pages, you see that it's not talking about the fat of birds or fish. You know, oily fish is good, and even the fat of chickens or birds is not prohibited. But here in chapter 7, verse 23, verse 22, and the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, you shall eat no manner of fat of ox, sheep, or goat. So, these are the ones, you know, the fat from which we get suet. Certainly, your suet, and suet would go into mince pies. You've got to be careful when you're getting mince pies that it's vegetarian mince pies. If we go and get an ordinary mince pie, the mince pie can have suet in. The traditional recipe for mince pie is suet. That's the oily part. So we need to be a bit careful with that because it's specifically forbidden. The suet, and it says here, you shall eat no manner of fat of ox or sheep or of goat. So I know my father used to enjoy certain amounts of fat. Actually, I used to enjoy a certain amount of fat. I used to enjoy bacon fat, if I'm actually honest, but as a little lad. You shall eat no manner of fat, of ox, or sheep, or goat, and the fat of the beast that dies of itself, and the fat of that which is torn of beast may be used for any other use, but you will not eat it. So you can make soap of it, no problem. You can make soap. You can boil it up, you get your lye from your wood ash, and you mix it up with your fat from your animals, and you boil it up in a great big tub, and you can make your hillbilly soap, and that's perfectly okay. For whosoever eats the fat of the beast, which men offer an offering made by fire to the Eternal, even the soul that eats it shall be cut off from his people. Moreover, you shall eat no manner of blood, whether it's of fowl or beasts, in any of your dwellings. Now, I want you to notice the difference. With fat, you shall eat no manner of fat of ox or sheep or goat. With blood, it's fowl or beasts as well. So, fish oils, chicken, really, fat is almost like an oil, is okay. But when you're looking at blood, you don't eat it at all. You keep away from it. I remember being asked one time on one of my trips, is it right, because there was a delicacy in the country that I was visiting, of eating a chicken while it was still in its egg. Is that all right? And what do you answer to that? Well, I prayed very quickly, and it suddenly popped into my mind, well, it's not blood, so no, it's not all right, because you don't eat blood. So you can't bleed a chicken in the egg. It's not possible. So if it's developed to such a degree, and if you get an egg which is starting to develop, you should get rid of the blood that's in there, because you do get blood in there. We shouldn't be eating blood at all, including animals, including chickens as well. Now, this subject of the fat is a valid one. It's something that we do need to take notice of. I know that the Welsh cowl, I mean, if you ever go to a Welsh, apart from the fact it could well be made with pork as well, they seem to like fatty meat in the Welsh cowl. I mean, for all of you listening that don't know what Welsh cowl is, it's if you imagine the old witch's pot, they used to keep it over the fire, and they would leave the thing there, and it would just stay there simmering all the time. And if you had anything left over, you just chuck it in the Welsh cowl, and that would be the soup for the day. And anything, any bits of meat that were left over from salting the pig or whatever would go into the cowl. And I've had cowl even in members' homes, where quite frankly, I had to fish amongst the fat in order to find something fit to eat. It shouldn't be. That should not be the case. In the members' homes, we should not be eating fat. It says you should not eat fat of ox or sheep or goat. Now, chicken fat is another thing. Fish oils is another thing. That's fine. But not of... and certainly not of pig, obviously. And that goes without saying. But even when we've got mince, the trouble is, when we've got mince, mince so often is... anything goes through the mincer. And they even then dye it in order to make it look red. They get this grey mince that comes out the other end, and they dye it to make it look red, to make it look better than it is. We should be very, very careful indeed. It's worth paying that extra to get purely lean mince. And if you can't afford it, then at least take the pan. If you fry it first, and then you, after frying it, the juice that will be there, if you put it, break the mince up to the top, put it on an angle, and allow the fat to settle out. The fat will then drain away, or you know, grill it in such a way that the fat it comes out of it. But we should not be eating fat. Sausages are another thing that we need to be very, very careful with. It's not the case of a beef sausage is always all right. It's not. It's not the beef, the fact that it's beef. It's the fact that it got so much fat in it. That's a problem. We should not be eating fat. It's not good for us. You know, this was known by the Jews years and years, well, centuries and millennia before it came up and people started to understand that, no, you shouldn't be eating fat. And now they're discovering that, no, it's not the fat that it's not the fact that it's being cooked in fat, it's what kind of fat, and what kind of oil. In other words, olive oil is fine. You can go ahead and deep fry in olive oil. In this area as well, if I can make a couple of other comments, is that we should in fact cook the meat. Now, you can put in your notes, and you read it yourself, in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 32, how they actually ate it with the blood. Now, I've read this section, and I know people who say that, oh, well, the pink in the meat is just the natural colour. Well, I'm sorry, I can't reconcile myself personally. I can't reconcile 1 Samuel 14:32 with the idea that if you don't cook the meat thoroughly, it's allowing the blood to stay there. No, maybe you can, but I know that I've had certain... I wouldn't say arguments, but mild disagreements with people on this. But we should be cooking the meat. It makes sense to cook it. Now, what about beef jerky? Well, again, drying it, again, it's okay. It gets rid of the blood in that sense that it is there. But I'm not talking about dried blood sausage or anything like that, but it processes it in such a way. But the fact that we do eat food which is of benefit, it's not only ourselves eating the food which is of benefit, it's the actual animals themselves as well. If you think about the animals, I know we don't eat horses, but the bluegrass in Kentucky. The bluegrass in Kentucky, it's not just the music, the bluegrass music that Kentucky is famous for, it's the bluegrass that's in the Kentucky hills that gives rise to the racing stock. Presumably it must be calcium, I would have thought, that gives the strength of the bone, the strength and the lightness of the bone. And that strength and lightness is not only in the animals that eat the bluegrass, but has somehow got into the very DNA of the animals, because they then export the bluegrass racing stock around the world, and it improves the stock of the animals that they are then siring. So it almost seems as if it gets into the genes themselves, and it talks about the actual blessings being to the third and the fourth generations, and hating people. I'm not sure, one says 1,000 generations, the other one's third and fourth generation. And you look at the way the grass actually evolves, it's probably the right word actually, evolves the genetic stock of the animal, of Herefords, say, the Limousin. You know, the people in France that bred the Limousin, they probably had a very great area that would allow the stock to improve. The Aberdeen Angus, the Holstein, the Frisian over in Holland, the Jersey and Guernsey. You know, it was actually bred into the animal, and they actually took some of the feeding that was given to it on the island of Jersey, on the island of Guernsey, and then they take it across the world, and it's built into the very genes. And so we are going to have to teach this understanding to the nations when there's a word behind them saying this is the way, walk in it, because it's going to actually alter the very genetic stock. It's going to make sure that the stock remains intact the way it needs to be for the people in the millennium. But as I said, it's a case of becoming as near natural as we possibly can. So going on to the final point, turn over to Revelation 18 with me, if you would, please. Because this is a continual battle. A continual battle. Revelation 18. It says in verse 2, it says, "And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, is become the habitation of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird." He's talking about literally the spirit realm, and how the influence on Babylon the Great, and remember, Babylon the Great, yes, it's a church system, but it goes beyond that. It goes into a way of thinking. It goes into a way, a philosophy of mind. It's a satanic. It's the people who are being influenced by Satan at the end time in the European theatre. That's what it's talking about. And verse 9. "And the kings of the earth that have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing far off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, the great city Babylon, the mighty city, for in one hour your judgment is come." It's not necessarily a single metropolis that it's talking about, but it is the entire system. It's the entire bustle. The word city literally means to bustle. It's the entire economic bustle of Babylon that will form the economic system at the very end time. And that economic system is going to be utterly, totally destroyed. And it says, "And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore." That's the problem. And the defining area of Babylon, defining area of this chaos, is going to be the merchandising of everything. "The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones, and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and thyme wood, and all the manner of vessels of ivory and vessels of most precious wood and brass and iron and marble and iPods and everything else." And then it goes on. It says, "And cinnamon and odours, the spices, and ointments and frankincense, the makeup and perfumeries and so on. And wine and oil and fine flour and wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and bodies and slaves and souls of men. And the fruit of the soul lusts after are departed from you. And all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from you, and you shall find them no more. And the merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off from the fear of their torment, weeping and wailing and saying, Alas, alas, that great city." So here we see the merchants of the earth bewailing the destruction of Babylon and destruction of the system that is there. Now, as I said, the fact is that Babylon is based on a satanic system. It's a satanic frame of mind. It's based on selfishness, of incoming, well, Satan's way of mind is vanity and selfishness. I was looking at this magazine. I won't say who it's from over the air, because he actually goes on the website. But it's of a large supermarket, let's put it that way, a very large supermarket. And you go through it, and I was looking through this, and I thought, there's one particular section, in fact, it's not just one section, it goes through several sections, where it's talking about going green. It's talking about the doing your bit for the environment, taking the eco challenge, be part of Climate Week and all this kind of thing, and how wonderful this particular company is in supporting this wonderful initiative of going green and making sure that the waste is properly recycled and all this rest of it, the information that's in here. And I thought, you hypocrites. The very reason why the world is in such a mess is because of the packaging that these companies are insisting on. I was thinking to myself that when I was a young boy, I would go down to the greengrocers, which is about half a mile away, something like that, and walk down there. And I'd go and get some carrots. And my mother would send me out for carrots with some money. And there wasn't a problem with walking out as a young boy at that time. And you just didn't think about it. And they would weigh the carrots in the scales. I'd open my bag and they'd pour them in. And I'd then walk off with the carrots. And that's the way it was done. No packaging at all. And you know, if you wanted a bag, then fine. You can have a paper bag. But that was the way it was. And yet the supermarkets have packaged everything to the nth degree. And then they've got a problem. And in addition to that, when you made a fridge, you made a fridge to last in days gone by. Today you've got fridges that last as long as the manufacturer wants them to last, and not a moment longer. And in other words, up to their sell-by date, and up to their guaranteed date, and that's it. Once your guarantee date has gone past a sufficient distance to cause the, not necessarily one day, but I mean, it might be a few weeks, so that you at least get over the idea that I'll never buy one of those again, kind of feeling. They're then designed to be broken. And therefore, you look at this system, and you look at this, and everybody in this magazine is smiling. The ladies are made up to the nines. They've got plastered with makeup. And the whole thing is a total con. It's a total con job. When you're looking at this magazine, you're looking at a system which is showing, which is treating sons of God, potential sons of God, as consumers. And it's interesting that Mr. Armstrong made a comment in the Key to Radiant Health. This is from the February 1982 Plain Truth. He says, "Today nearly everything we eat passes through man's hands or his factories before it comes to the consumer. In the interest of bigger profits, the gigantic food industry is giving us a diet of foodless foods," in quotes. Take wheat. Wheat is almost a perfect food. It contains all 16 major food elements in near perfectly balanced proportions. But they take the perfect grain of wheat apart, rob it of the 12 mineral elements, turn it into white flour containing the 4 carbohydrate elements. Why? Well, if they were to give you the whole wheat flour, it would spoil after so long a time. And in the big business distribution system, the flour may not reach the consumer until after it spoils, and that would mean a loss to the food industry. One dietitian gave this advice: "My basic rule in diet is eat only the natural foods that will spoil and eat them before they do." That is a very good advice. So again, we're looking at principles. Now, what Mr. Armstrong didn't know about, as far as I understand he didn't know about, is radioactive mutagenesis. Now, radioactive mutagenesis, by the time probably this article was published in 1982, had already taken place. So what they actually did was take wheat and they took it down to a nuclear power station and they irradiated it. They then sowed the wheat and they were looking for changes, mutations, radioactive mutagenesis, in other words, mutations that would occur. The vast majority of wheat was totally deformed. It either didn't germinate at all, or if it did grow, it grew into something which is a monstrosity. Sometimes, however, certain changes took place, and one change took place in the radioactive mutagenesis wheat, and that was an additional molecule of gluten. And I strongly, strongly imagine that that is the reason why we've got problems today, because once that genie is out of the bottle, the wind will carry the pollination to all and sundry. So today, unfortunately, the wheat is the way to do it. Or whole grains, let's put it that way, whole grains is the way forward. But be careful, because they've messed about with the grain. And as they've got the bioengineering now, they're going to do it more and more and more. It's interesting, I was reading an article about sugar, saying Max Pemberton in the Telegraph, this is the 6th of February, he said about sugar, can sugar be really toxic? He says, sadly, yes. He says, what makes the added sugar so dangerous, argued the researchers, is that fructose from refined sugar is primarily broken down in the liver, unlike glucose, which is slowly released from complex carbohydrates during digestion. So again, when we're looking at trying to get something as natural as possible, be aware. Yes, sugar is useful to have as a preservative, but boy, we need to be very careful about the quantity that we eat. And the way things are, this is from the Daily Mail on Thursday, this last Thursday, February the 16th. Children's cereals so sugary that they should be in the biscuit aisle. Kellogg's Frosties are 37% sugar. Now, Kellogg's Frosties are quite a common, I don't know whether you have Frosties over in America, I don't know, I'm not sure. But 37%, 37 grams in every 100. Tesco Choco Snaps are 36%, as are Asda as well, and Morrison's as well. And Sainsbury's, would you know, they're all the same, 36 grams per 100. Waitrose Choco Pops, 36 grams. They're all the same. Honey Monster Sugar Puffs, 35 grams. And on it goes. All these well-known brands, the various things called Morrison's Honey Nut Corn Flakes. Sounds good, doesn't it? Honey Nut. The chances are the amount of honey in there is minuscule. 33 grams. And yet you go to Weetabix, 4 grams. Quaker Oats, 1 gram. And shredded wheat, 0.7 of a gram. So it gives an indication of what in fact is in there. But sugar, can it be really toxic? It's being asked. It says this slowly released from a complex carbohydrates during digestion. The strain that this refined sugar puts on the liver starts a process that can lead to fatty liver disease and liver failure. But most importantly, its presence can trigger the development of type 2 diabetes. This is because higher levels of sugar in the blood mean that the pancreas has got to produce large amounts of insulin, a hormone that helps control and keep stable blood sugar, by promoting its uptake by cells which need it for energy. Over time, the pancreas becomes fatigued and starts to fail. And at the same time, cells in the body become increasingly resistant to the effects of insulin, and so blood sugar levels remain high with damaging consequences. So there's a major problem with having too much sugar in the diet, and we need to make sure we understand this. So you think, well, why doesn't the government do something about it? Let me read the way he finishes. According to accounts released by Parliament until December 2009, the Health Secretary, Andrew Lansley, has been earning £25,000 a year for 12 days work as a non-executive director of Profero, a marketing agency whose major clients include Pepsi Cola, making of Pepsi, confectioner Mars, and so Mars and Pepsi Cola. And they basically are sugary consumers of sugar, or one of the greatest consumers of sugar. This experience clearly gives Mr. Lansley a sweet tooth, because last year he decided, as part of plans to relax regulations on salt and sugar in foods, to enlist McDonald's, Mars, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and other fast food company to give the Department of Health advice on healthy eating campaigns. and healthy health policy. Critics at the time likened it to placing the tobacco industry in charge of smoke-free spaces. Given the clear potential of conflict of interest between these companies and the nation's sugar intake, what hope is there of real change? It would seem sugar's toxic effects are far-reaching. So be aware, this idea of consumers and the idea of big business is going right into the very food. It goes into the legislation as well. And it is something that we all need to be aware of. And the fact is that if we have been raised on a diet of Cocoa Pops or Sugar Puffs or you know, Frosties or whatever, we need our diet, our palate, retrained. Our diet is you know, you don't need sugar. You have apples, stewed apples. You do not need sugar in stewed apples. You think, oh, I don't like sugar. Right, fine. Well, you need your palate retrained. There's no problem. If you want a sweetener of some description, a little honey, but it needs to be a little honey because of what it says in Proverbs. A little honey does in fact help it to sweeten it. But don't load up on the honey either, because again, the Proverbs warns against that. I didn't put it down in my notes, so I wouldn't be able to find it if I looked for it. So we are students. We are students of a certain way of life, and our palates do indeed need to be retrained. Another area. The bread preservative 282. Now, if you've ever come across something on a loaf of bread that says, now with extra calcium. Okay. It says here, the use of calcium propionate, that's 282, as a preservative in bread, became widespread in the early 1990s. This preservative is rarely used in Europe or New Zealand, used increasingly in the UK, and is common in Australia and the US. Consumers are often confused by a label claiming, quote, now with extra calcium. Calcium propionate is used for the propionate, not the calcium. It says calcium propionate and the other propionates occur naturally in many foods and dairy products like Swiss cheese. In small amounts, they're not harmful, but as with other additives, the effects of the dose are dose-related. Very few people will be affected by two slices of preserved bread, but effects are cumulative, so they can build up slowly over days or weeks, varying with the dose. This makes identification of the cause of symptoms extremely difficult. Reactions can be anything from the usual range of food intolerance systems, migraines, headaches, gastrointestinal symptoms, stomach aches, irritable bowel, diarrhea, urinary urgency, eczemas, itchy skin rashes, nasal congestion, depression, tiredness, impairment of memory and concentration, speech delay, fast heartbeat, growing pains, and on it goes. One thing after another. Propionates are one of the most difficult additives to avoid because their use is widespread and they are in healthy foods that are generally eaten every day. In less than one generation, many have gone from eating nothing of this preservative to eating it every day of their lives. So when you see something, it says, it gives two examples. It says, my breastfed baby's son screamed for the first 3.5 months of his life all day and half the night until my doctor got me onto a dietitian for the elimination diet. He reacts when I eat most additives, but the bread preservative is the worst. He screams in agony, and remember, this is going through the breast milk. He screams in agony within 24 hours and often gets a red rash on his face, back and stomach. Before we tried the diet, we were hospitalized twice because I couldn't cope. So this thing is not, you know, just mild. It says, another one, my daughter is nearly 5 years old. When we did the elimination diet, we found that she reacts to bread preservative, some other preservatives, and MSG. Her reactions to the bread preservatives range from temper tantrums to very moody pre-diet behavior. This includes hitting and gnawing a brother and sister that are trying to do homework, or just generally whingy and demanding behavior and refusing to do as requested. At night, she wakes up from 1 to 5 times a night and walks the house. When we put her back on the preservative-free bread, her behavior changed back to good behavior within 3 or 4 days. Now, this is what is actually happening. And you can see over and over again, so much of this, and as I say, what is the actual reason for this? Let me see if I actually find. Yeah, it says, contrary to what food industry would like you to believe, this additive is not to keep your bread fresh. Calcium propionate is added to inhibit the growth of mould. There is no mould on a freshly baked loaf of bread, so why use a mould inhibitor? Bakers who keep their workbenches and slicer blades clean and mould-free by wiping with vinegar every day do not need this additive. However, bakers in large factories prefer the less time-consuming method of fogging their equipment with a chemical spray. Putting hot loaves in plastic bags makes the problem worse, and preservative 282 allows for sloppy hygiene. It's for the convenience of the manufacturer, not the consumer. And this is the problem. We have become consumers. We're no longer sons of God. We're no longer human beings. We're mere consumers of these big businesses. And that is the heart and core of the problem. And you find taking the junk out of, banning food additives to make pupils better behaved. Growing evidence of links between disruptive behaviour and common food additives, schools are seeking control over their pupils' diets. We know that some children react very badly to additives, said Pam Fitzpatrick, the head of New End Primary School in Hampstead, London. It's amazing how many so-called healthy snacks, such as flavoured waters and fruit bars, have E-numbers in them. But fizzy drinks and brightly coloured sweets are the worst. Take my own grandson, one mouthful of cola, and I'll have him to peel him off the ceiling. And this does happen. This happens within the church, and we need to be aware of that. Again, these things can be quite gross. One of the worst things I'll pass it on for what I've heard. It says many packaged breads. This is coming from. It's a Yahoo Net thing on health. It says many packaged breads and baked goods contains L-cysteine, a non-essential amino acid made from dissolved human hair and feathers. So dissolved human hair and feathers, often from China, food manufacturers use the ingredient for a commercial dough conditioner meant to improve the texture of breads and baked goods. So if you see L-cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E, I would say that's unclean, wouldn't you? It goes on. Big food corporations often add the chemical titanium dioxide, commonly found in paints and sunscreens, to process foods like salad dressings, coffee creamer, and canned icing to make them appear whiter. That titanium dioxide is a component of the metallic element titanium. It says it's sometimes contaminated with lead. It's an awful lot better if you go ahead and have olive oil or vinegar-based dressings. But again, what we need to be aware of is that we need to be reading the label. We need to be aware that microwaves are not the normal way of processing foods, that margarines are not natural, they're hydrogenated oils. They're presented and produced and presented to the consumer as being more natural. They're not more natural. You go to as near natural a position as possible. He says you eat things that are able to rot and you eat them before they do. And that basically is good advice for all of us. And reading the label and making sure that radiated foods and so on are kept out of the way. Turn over to a couple of scriptures in closing. Mark 16. More and more, this is the case that we're going to have to rely on God to do exactly what he says here. It says, these are the signs that will follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out demons, they will speak with new languages, they will take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. Now, I would say within that is the understanding, if we turn back to Matthew chapter 15, we see the way in which Christ looked on food. Matthew 15. And it says in verse 34, and Jesus said to them, "How many loaves have you?" And he said, "Seven and a few little fish." And these were not mass-produced. They weren't chemically treated. They were perfectly natural. And it says, and he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the seven loaves and the fish, and he gave thanks. And he broke them, and he gave to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitude. But that was his natural, normal way of having food, is that he would give thanks. And so we too also need to make sure that we give thanks. We aim as near as possible to the natural foods to make sure that we have as near to natural foods as possible. But food is there to enjoy, and we should be enjoying it. But we should be retraining our palate. Our palate should be retrained to enjoy the natural foods, the way that God made those foods, and to do so because it's part of the way of God. It's part of the mindset of God, and we have got to teach that mindset, teach that way of God in the future. This is part of the very glorious liberty of the sons of God, is the teaching of that mindset in relation to food. For it is in the fact that we treat human beings not as consumers, but as sons of God.